morning and welcome to MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. Happy Sunday before Inauguration Day. Barack Obama will take the oath as the 44th President of the United States on Tuesday at 11 a.m. Central Time, 12 o'clock D.C. time. And he has, by all accounts, hit the ground running with his transition team, with his cabinet appointments, with his stimulus package proposals. But already the sounds of consternation can be heard in the Congress. So what sorts of opposition can he expect to face? What sorts of public support can he expect to help him guide the country through difficult economic times and international insecurity? And incidentally, what about that puppy? You knew we'd get to that. Dr. Rob McDaniel, assistant professor of political science, is back to look ahead to the Obama administration. Thanks for being here, Doc.
Good morning, Janet. It's great to be back.
Hey, it's great to have you back. Congress has released the rest of the bailout package on a 52-42 vote, but only six Republicans voted to release the rest of that bailout money, even though Obama has appointed an accountability czar to try to make sure that this money is better spent to help the economy, gets down to the banks, gets down to the mortgage holders who need it, than the first part of the bailout package was spent during the waning days of the Bush administration. So whatever happened to, yes, we can, and we're all working on this together, and we're doing this in a spirit of bipartisanship?
Well, that was the Obama campaign theme, and I think he's clearly made significant strides in that direction. He's reached out to Republican members of Congress. He's called them on the phone. He's been to see them. There was a lot of publicity this week when Obama had a dinner party at the house of George Will, the prominent conservative columnist, syndicated columnist, who's also at the Washington Post. And at that dinner, he had David Brooks and Bill Kristol from the New York Times, prominent conservatives.
Peggy Noonan
and Paul Gigot from the Wall Street Journal. And he's really making a serious effort. In fact, I think the most serious effort that we've seen from any recent president to reach out in systematic ways to Republicans and
keeping Gates on as defense secretary.
Well, that's right. Keeping Gates on as defense secretary is a especially good example of that. Jim Jones, who's going to be his NSA, is somebody who is well respected on both sides of the aisle, and I think is widely thought to be a kind of closet Republican, although one who Democrats have a lot of, I think, common ground with. And so Obama has done a lot, I think, to reach out. He's done far more than any recent president to embrace bipartisanship and bring Republicans in, both in his cabinet and in terms of working with them in Congress and with opinion leaders. But the situation is not symmetrical. Republicans, in some ways, are in a bind, and part of the problem is the lingering effect of the Bush years. Over the last, and it's really not just the Bush years, it's really the effect, I'd say, of the last 15 or 20 years, ever since the Republican Revolution of 1994, when they took over Congress, which is that the Republican Party has been polarizing farther and farther to the right, as the Democrats have generally been moderating. The effect of the Clinton years of the 90s was really to moderate the Democratic Party, get rid of a lot of the old cultural extremism, especially on a lot of sort of values issues and things like that, and to create a kind of fiscally sound, economically and culturally moderate party. And meanwhile, the Republicans have been polarizing more and more to the right, fueled in many ways by Fox News and talk radio, and by even seemingly mainstream outlets like the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, which under Paul Gigot has become increasingly radical and in some ways very much outside the mainstream.
And after the Journal was taken over by Rupert Murdoch.
And the Journal was eventually taken over by Rupert Murdoch, that's right, who, of course, owns Fox. And so the Republican base is really, really far to the right these days. And so when Republican congressmen go home and they listen to the people who voted for them, what they hear is often obstruct. They hear, we hate the bailout, we don't want you to help the new administration. And so they are in some ways in a, between a rock and a hard place. They want to cater to their base. And in fact, that was the Bush Rove strategy for the last 8 years, always give the base exactly what it wants. And as a result of that, they really don't really know what the language of moderation and compromise is. And it's not clear that this, there's a scenario by which they learn those things unless it is repeated electoral losses. I mean, 2006, 2008, landslides for Democrats. But even then, Republicans are still, they're still out there on the ideological ledge to some extent. And I think it may take another couple of elections like that. And I don't know that there will be another couple of elections like that. And so as a result of that, I don't know that Barack Obama can really expect that he's going to have a lot of Republican votes for most of the agenda items that he wants to push through.
Dr. Frank Essex, who is a professor emeritus of political science here, was a congressional page when he was in high school during World War II. And one of the things he told me was that one reason FDR was able to accomplish so much is that he had uncommon Republican cooperation in the Congress because the times were so dire that they virtually demanded it. Is that what we're partly what we are lacking? The Obama talks about the fierce urgency of now, which is a line that he co-opted from or borrowed from Martin Luther King. But are there still some elected officials who don't feel the fierce urgency that he feels?
Oh, I think that's right. And the example of the Great Depression is a really good example. It's been used a lot and in some ways maybe overused. But I think actually one of the best comparisons is between the current era, the decade that we've been living in, the spans from, say, 2000 to 2009, as very comparable to the span between 1920 and 1929, where you have conservative Republican governments in place. And in pursuing deregulatory free market, pro-business kinds of policies, you end up having the market self-destruct, because there aren't safeguards in place. And by 1929, of course, you have a market collapse. What happens, though, is that, of course, that Herbert Hoover, who is sort of the John McCain of his day, has recently taken over as president. He's the most respected man in his party. He's a man of integrity who has impeccable humanitarian credentials. And so Republicans get a chance to do this on their own for 4 years with the best man they have positioned to handle it. And because of his own adherence to an ideology that's really being discredited by events, he himself isn't able to handle it. And so as a result of that, in the Great Depression, the stock market crashes in 1929, but you don't go from unemployment of 3% to 25% just overnight. As you apply these sort of Republican free market principles, things just get worse and worse and worse year after year. And so by the time FDR takes over in 1933, he's had a landslide election. There's been a long, long period of discredited Republican rule that has really given him a lot of ground to move. Republicans are beaten down by their own failure at this point. And I think the parallel to today is this, that in many ways the current decade has been like the 1920s, but it's as if the Democrats took over in 1930 instead of 1933, that they didn't have that long period of failed Republican response to the economic crisis. They've had a short period of failed Republican response to an economic crisis. And as a result of that, the Republican mindset hasn't changed that much, because most Republicans in Congress, I think, and Republican opinion leaders still believe that the Republican solutions will work. And of course, we don't really know if they would work or not, because, we're not going to have that same period of 4 years of Republican efforts to fix the situation as we did in the early 1930s or late 1920s and early 1930s. But in many ways, I think that's the proper parallel. And because of that, Obama doesn't have the same kind of leeway. He doesn't have the same kind of opposition party to deal with that Roosevelt did.
There have been some hiccups with regard to his appointments to cabinet-level post with Tim Geithner and Hillary Clinton and Eric Holder, but I think it's fascinating to observe that these are basically just being regarded as hiccups along the way. And at the confirmation hearings, whatever objections are being raised seems to be just considered as the usual congressional grandstanding to satisfy the conservative constituents back home that you really are on the case and you're not going to let the incoming administration get away with anything, but in the end you're going to vote for them anyway. So it's there really doesn't seem to be much of a problem. If there's evidence of bipartisanship, it's that they're willing to give Obama his people, the people he wants, which is traditional whenever a president sends nominations up to the Hill, unless there's some really dire ugliness in their past.
And I think hiccups is exactly the right word. I think that that's all that these really are. And I think part of the credit has to go to Obama because the nominations, at least from what we know, have been extraordinarily good nominations. There haven't been many cases where you just scratch your head and think, what was he doing when he nominated that person for this particular job?
With the possible exception of Bill Richardson. But even right. That has not been cataclysmic.
Well, that's right. In fact, they handled that exactly right. They got him out, or he got himself out, depending upon which reports you read, but before the hearings. And if a nomination goes down during hearings, that's a lot worse because it drags it out. It's much more high profile. And in his case, they saw this happening early and they realized it was going to be a problem. And so he pulled out. And meanwhile, with Richardson, I think they get a pass to some extent because Richardson is a guy who had just run for president in the Democratic primaries. He was a candidate who went pretty far along. He was not necessarily in the top tier along with Obama and Clinton and Edwards, but he was right below that. He was in the next batch, and he waged his campaign for a long time. And so I think a lot of people just assumed he had been vetted, that process would have brought out anything significant that might discredit him. And I think we found out that it didn't. And on top of that, I think that there's the Hispanic factor. Obama's trying to create a diverse cabinet. Hispanics were very important in his election. It was important for him to have a high-profile Hispanic in a significant post. A lot of people thought that Richardson should have been Secretary of State. And so Obama was in some ways doing some constituency pleasing with that nomination, too. And I think that in retrospect, Obama is lucky that he didn't nominate Richardson for Secretary of State. And so having nominated him for Secretary of Commerce, getting some credit from that from the Hispanic community, and then having that when things went bad, having that nomination withdrawn very quickly, is almost a best case scenario of events for him. And it has to be partly luck, I think, that it turned out that way. But I think that that case really worked out well from a strictly political standpoint. And the other cases, the Tim Geithner and paying taxes, and I think that those things are really minor. And the one person who Republicans had made a significant stink about is Eric Holder, who is Obama's nominee for Attorney General. And by all accounts, the testimony in front of Congress this week went really, really well for Eric Holder. The Republican arguments against Eric Holder were fairly weak to begin with, I think. Arlen Specter, I think, mostly jockeying for position with his constituency. He faced a tough challenge from the right wing of his party in the primary last time he ran for Senate. And I think that he's mostly positioning himself with respect to those folks in Pennsylvania by challenging Eric Holder. But they don't really have much of an argument, I think, in going after him on his participation in the pardon of Mark Rich during the Clinton administration. And as a result of that, I think that he's going to get through pretty easily, too.
As in the waning days of the Bush administration, as we see the Bush legacy project underway in an effort to repair, refurbish, emboss, put sheen over the 8 years of the Bush administration moves forward, and the 43rd president delivered his farewell address and held his last press conference of his administration, my impression is that the continuing lack of introspection and lack of intellectual curiosity that outgoing President Bush displays only tends to heighten Obama's calm, intellectual, deliberative demeanor even more as the incoming chief executive. Do you agree or disagree?
Oh, I do agree. I mean, I think that in some ways one of the best presents that George Bush could give to Barack Obama is his continuing presence on the national stage to remind people of the contrast between the two. In some ways, it's been pathetic. I mean, if I were one of Bush's handlers, I would have told him to lay low as much as possible. And, in some ways, I think that historians are going to look back at the Bush presidency and they're going to label it the public relations presidency. If you look at what the Bush administration has done, they were in many ways experts at public relations. But at some point along the way, if the product you're selling isn't very good, there's only so much a good advertising campaign is going to be able to do. And eventually that's what caught up with them. The longer people had exposure to the actual product, which was the policies that they put forward, the less people liked it. And once that has taken hold, there's only so much spinning that you can do. And in fact, the more spinning you do, the more credibility that you lose. And so I think that as a result of that, they should cut their losses. And the whole legacy project idea, I think, has become something of a joke. And they really need to take a much more cautious, studied approach. They need to give themselves some time and get out of Washington. And a little bit of introspection really wouldn't hurt. I mean, I don't think you're going to get it from George Bush, but the conservative movement itself really needs to engage in some. And I believe strongly that we need a strong conservative movement in the United States, but not one that's driven by extremes. And there are a lot of smart people on the conservative wing of American politics, and they're going to have to engage in some real soul searching. But it's not going to be from people like George Bush that I think that we ultimately get that.
There is a considerable drumbeat right now for the prosecution of Bush, Cheney, and other Bush administration officials for war crimes with regard to Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, waterboarding, other such issues in which the administration stepped over the line in their efforts to preserve national security. Morally and ethically, can the Obama administration do that? Politically, do they dare do that, or will they have time to do that, to pursue that, with everything else on their plate regarding the future of the country?
That's a great question. This really puts them in a bind, I think. I think we all know that there were a lot of abuses under the Bush administration, that rule of law is really taking a beating over the last 8 years, and that's true when you talk about torture and wiretapping. And I think that one of the most publicized recent examples is the U.S. Attorney's scandal at the Justice Department, especially when it was under Alberto Gonzalez. The Justice Department's a wreck. It's a disaster. And it's going to take a long time to clean that up. And there have been reports in the past week in particular about a guy named Bradley Schlotzman, who was in charge of the Civil Rights Division and was a deputy assistant attorney general and very clearly broke the law in hiring only people who were clearly conservative right-wing activists for positions that were supposed to be nonpartisan. And hiring people because of their ideological purity, caring more about what they think about Roe versus Wade than their actual qualifications for the job. And then he very clearly went up and lied to Congress pretty brazenly about it. And so, one of the questions is, what do we do with these folks? Obviously, there are a lot of violations of the rule of law. And these aren't even things you have to dig very much for. They're right there on the surface. And with torture, I think a very similar kind of situation. In the last 2 weeks, both President Bush and Vice President Cheney have said very publicly and very proudly that they approved of all of the specific tactics used on all of the various prisoners in Guantanamo and, people who were, at various military bases, Bagram, for example, and so on, and that they didn't consider it torture because they defined it in a very, very narrow way. But what they the way they defined it is not the way that international law defines it. It's not the way that American law defines it. And in some ways, they're daring the Obama administration to come at them on this. They're not even really hiding what happened. But it's a minefield because a new president's only got so much capital. Obama has a lot of crises to deal with, economic, foreign. He's got to find a way to get us out of Iraq in a reasonable time frame. He's got to find a way to improve the situation in Afghanistan, which is deteriorating, and address the most serious financial crisis in 70 years. And as a result of that, he doesn't have a lot of time. He doesn't have a lot of capital to put into going back over the massive lawbreaking that's taken place over the last 8 years. And he clearly, I think, wants to wash his hands of it. He doesn't want to have much to do with it, but he may not have much choice, especially if Eric Holder turns out to be a quote, independent attorney general, somebody who puts the needs of the rule of law above the needs of the president and sees himself as the people's lawyer. He may strike out in those directions in ways that go beyond what is in Obama's political self-interest. And so it'll be really interesting to see how that works. In fact, I think Republicans probably ought to hope that Holder is not as independent as they are asking him to be, because it is in both Obama and the Republicans' interest right now that he let a lot of those things slot.
Turning to the foreign policy front, it's funny watching certain television shows conversation shows on which conservative pundits appear, they're baiting Obama, virtually goading Obama to make a major statement about the violence in Gaza, when Obama has stated time and again, there's only one president at a time, and clearly he did not want to look like an interloper, an ambassador without portfolio or whatever you want to call it, while Bush was still the president of the United States. Now, after he takes the oath of office, what sort of an approach do you think the administration will take to Gaza and the entire Middle East situation?
Again, that's a really good question, I think. And I think that there's going to be a change from the way that the Bush administration approached it. I think that Obama is, as he's said over and over again, and his record demonstrates, very strongly pro-Israel. But I think he has a very different sense of what it means to be pro-Israel than what the Bush administration thought. And I think that the Obama administration's tack will be to hold that the U.S. being something of a neutral broker. A neutral broker who, you know, recognizes that Israel is its close friend and ally, but somebody who can mediate disputes with a bit more even hand can create a more stable security situation for Israel. As a result of that, I expect the Obama administration to put more pressure on Israel when it comes to situations like Gaza, and when it comes to situations like settlements on the West Bank. I expect Obama to be a bit firmer about that, not turning away from Israel, but trying to convince Israel that some compromises in those areas are in Israel's own long-term self-interest, and I think that there's a pretty strong case for that. With the Gaza situation, it's hard to know how things are going to shake out. I think there are a lot of experts, and I don't really know this area especially well, but from what I understand, I think there are a lot of experts on the ground in Israel and the Palestinian territories who think that this situation will be wrapped up by the time Obama takes office, that there's a window where Israel knew that it could attack because the Bush administration was lame duck and they weren't going to say anything, and before Obama became president. But that they didn't want to get off on the wrong foot. They didn't want the first thing that a new American president had to deal with to be the situation in Gaza. And so they wanted to get done what they could get done in a small window they were going to have. And then once that's over, they're going to make peace. Now, the time is running out for them to solve that before President-elect Obama gets inaugurated. But I think that there's good reason to think that there will be progress and the situation will be a bit calmer on, say, Wednesday than it is now.
Back on the domestic front, symbolism. The gay community was outraged that Rick Warren was chosen to deliver a prayer at the inauguration, overlooking the fact that Reverend Joseph Lowery is also chosen to deliver, I believe, the benediction. Rick Warren, the author of The Purpose-Driven Life, who has made some highly controversial statements about abortion and and gay rights and homosexuality in general. So perhaps in an effort to make amends, at the Sunday pre-inaugural event, Gene Robinson, the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church, will be speaking at an Obama event. How much does all of this mean, and what sorts of lasting effect will all of this have, if any? Does this say anything about Obama's approach to faith-based communities, or is it just a blip on the radar screen?
I think it's probably a blip. I don't tend to think that things like this matter that much, especially when compared to a whole range of decisions that President Obama is going to have to make in his first weeks and months in office. I mean, I think that those are the big things that he's going to be remembered for. And really, that, you know, the first 100 days, the actions that you take then really do define your presidency. But symbolic things like this, I think, matter much less. Now, that said, I think that picking Rick Warren in some ways was a brilliant move. He's gotten a lot of criticism on this from the left, but I think it's a very smart way to reach out to the evangelical community. And in some ways, what he's doing, he divides that community. The evangelicals have been strong Republican voters now for a generation, and really ever since Ronald Reagan in 1980. But evangelicals are very unhappy with the Bush administration. They are not especially happy with those policies. The major achievements of the Bush administration, which involved lowering taxes for wealthy income earners, are not the kinds of achievements that evangelical voters particularly care about. And so as a result of that, there's a real opportunity for Democrats to reach out to evangelicals and for evangelicals to in some ways increase their political power by becoming more of a swing bloc where both parties can potentially make a play for them. And so I think that Obama is recognizing this. I mean, I think Rick Warren's clearly a Republican. I think that most of his voters will still generally be Republican. But there are a lot of young evangelicals who are more culturally and economically moderate, who are concerned with issues of poverty and care for the oppressed, who think about economics and foreign policy from a standpoint of stewardship and in ways that I think Democrats like Obama can very much reach out to. And so in some ways, I think it's a brilliant move. And Obama has also at the same time done some things to calm the waters with the gay constituency within the Democratic Party.
My surprise is that people would think that just because he picked Rick Warren as a move to show that he is inclusive would be taken by some people as an indication that all of a sudden he was deserting gays or that his ideology had somehow gone to the point where it was in allegiance with Rick Warren, and that one necessarily led to the other. That's kind of a nonsensical quantum leap, to my mind. But in any event, we promised we would get to this as the quintessential kicker question. Teddy Kennedy has three Portuguese water dogs, and he's advising Obama to get a Portuguese water hound. One of Joe Biden's sons has a labradoodle, and he's advising Obama to get a labradoodle. Rob McDaniel's suggestion to the Obama family for a dog choice is...
Well, I don't know. We've got a lab border collie mix that I love. And so I don't know that it's hyperallergenic, though. So I don't know. My guess is that because of the Kennedy family and the fears that Teddy Kennedy may not be much longer for this world, that as a way of honoring Teddy in his last days, that they may go with go that route.
The politically correct choice to the end. I love it. Dr. Rob McDaniel, thank you for helping us preview the Obama years.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can listen to the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com. And we're also available on iTunes.